listen to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David Nicky Nellis. This is, unlike our regular show, that's a bit of a food and wine variety show. This is a deep dive into interesting subjects every week. And today we're going to be talking to folks from the Smithsonian Institution about the 2018 Smithsonian Food History Weekend, 11-1 to 11-3. Coming up shortly, it's going to be, well, it's going to be delicious. Let's say that.
Okay, it is going to be
first,
delicious.
But first, I can't hear you. Get on that mic.
You can hear me. Now can you hear me? You. No, my sound wasn't
But on. Speaking of delicious, we've got one of America's great mixologists with us, a legend in his own time and mind, Todd Thrasher.
Todd Thrasher.
Hello.
What a name. I mean, what a great name.
It's a stage name.
It's awesome.
Is it a stage name? Is your name really Henry Schmeckelson?
You know what it would sound good on? A bottle of rum.
I bet
you like Thrasher's,
Thrasher's
rum would have
rum?
A good ring to it or something like that.
Like that sign on the wharf that's
says
like my own personal smokestack.
Seriously, if I was dead, I could read the sign on
that's
the
right.
side of your distillery.
I want it a little bit bigger, though.
So I think
Todd,
it's pretty
Todd
fabulous.
Has a brand new distillery on the wharf in
coming
here in
soon,
D.C.
Coming soon.
It's right there, and it says Thrasher's Rum in letters so large.
Yeah.
It's yes. fabulous. So
yeah.
tell us a little bit about the property, please.
So
exciting.
We are opening a rum distillery in a bar called Tiki TNT, which I took 14 pallets of furniture today.
Woo-hoo!
So it must be getting close, right?
Yes.
Must be getting close. So we're on the wharf, 1130 Main Avenue, right
next
to
Officina. It's in the third phase.
Officina. Officina. Oh, my God.
Here we go again.
No,
come
not
on,
Officina.
Dude.
It's Officina.
Officina.
Whatever. I can't.
Oh
you know
God.
I can't pronounce it.
So opening soon. I'm looking, hopefully, like Election Day, because I think people will need to drink on Election Day.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a good
we'll
day
be there.
To kind of open. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So
but
we're looking. We're getting close.
We're getting ready
close.
To drink now. So
you're
what
drink
you make
now.
For us?
So, I am the spirited advisor here at the Line Hotel. So,
and on our show.
And on your show. That's right. And so this is a cocktail from our little restaurant in the back, a little stand-up restaurant from Eric Bruniang called Spoken English. And this is one of the cocktails back there. This is called I'm Having Ridiculous Thoughts.
Because if you drink this long enough, you won't be able to speak
English. Or
so
if you have
delicious.
Enough of them, you'll have ridiculous
okay,
thoughts.
Okay, so what are we... What's
so it is house squeezed cranberry juice. We make cranberry juice from scratch. Then I mixed it with a bunch of winter spices, star anise, clove, cinnamon, nutmeg, cooked it down with a little bit of sugar, and then it has bourbon, orange Colombier, and Virginia Fizz sparkling wine.
Is that all?
That's it.
So a little Claude Thibault.
So boring.
A little Claude Thibault.
So yep. Let me just ask you a quick question. Making your own cranberry juice.
Yes.
Why?
Because if you've ever looked at like Ocean Spray cranberry juice, where it has like 100 different
juice
ingredients.
Is it juice or is it drink?
The cocktail. Whatever, it doesn't matter if you're looking at the straight juice or the cocktail. As you get it, and through the course of the year, the color would always change on me.
Sure.
Like if it was in a can or if it was in a bottle, the color would be different all the time.
Interesting.
And it didn't look like cranberry juice. So one time at Restaurant Eve, I decided I'm going to make my own cranberry juice. So I got a 40-pound box of quick frozen cranberries, and I just started making cranberry juice from scratch, and it tastes better.
Okay.
And it looks better.
It's beautiful.
Except when anyone orders a Cosmo, they're like, oh, it's so pink.
Oh.
Yeah, because it's real cranberry juice.
Because it's real cranberry juice.
Do that voice again.
Oh, it's so pink.
But isn't like that the point of a Cosmo? Yeah. It's supposed to be pink.
Sounds like my grandma B.
Yes. All right, y'all. Have fun.
All right.
Have a good
bye,
day.
Bye, babe. All right. Keep us posted.
So just to reiterate, the 2018 Smithsonian Food History Weekend is your chance.
It's coming up.
To mix with culinary leaders and researchers and food professionals and scholars to talk about the history of food in America, your impact on the way food is in America, and how that impacts you and our future.
But what's really terrific here today is in studio, I've labeled them my dream team. This is the dream
you
team.
You see them dunk their donuts in the coffee of food. Never mind.
These are true food historians and food curators, and they have really taken the Smithsonian down a different track when it comes to history. And it's the history of food and drink and beer and how we all communicate with each other in our relationships, in our day-to-day lives, and how our past and our ancestors' past and how they ate and dined together or did agriculture, whatever it is, husbandry, etc., brought us to where we are today. I just think it's a it's a fascinating project. You all have worked so hard to curate it, and it's evolving, obviously. It's constantly growing. So with us today, I have Paula Johnson. She is the curator at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History, and she is responsible for the food technology and marine resources collections. We're going to find out more about what that means. And then we also have Teresa McCullough, who she is a historian dedicated to American brewing history.
Teresa's my favorite.
Okay. Sorry. Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of ladies. Boys who are like 21 years old, who are, or girls, actually, all people who could be like, yeah, I too want to learn how to curate beer. And then lastly, we have Ashley Rhodes Young. She is a food historian also at the National Museum of American History. And she is a program developer and host of Cooking Up History, which is a really cool monthly cooking demo, which I need to watch more of, obviously. So the three of you are here today because this huge weekend is going on. But I really want to talk a little bit about your individual roles. And I know David has wants the big question.
I want to start it from the start because, you know, I was born in Washington, grew up. All my degrees are in history. I lived at the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History and at the Air and Space Museum. I never really thought about food except at the concession stands. So how did this whole idea of food as a kind of a mirror of us and how we influence food and diet in America. Where'd that come from? Who started all of this?
Well, it's great to be here, by the way. And this is Paula. Food history has become a really important lens for the museum for exploring all sorts of American history. And what we have discovered over the years is that our collections, which date back to the mid-19th century, really have a lot to do with food history, even though they were collected because they were military objects, they were political objects, they were social and cultural history objects.
Well, how so?
Well, George Washington's camp tent plates and the deck stove from the gunboat Philadelphia from the Revolutionary War. I mean, there are these little food-related hints throughout the museum's collections and our exhibitions, and we started connecting some of those dots and realizing in the 1990s that there was a lot of interest in the scholarly community and in the public at large in what are we doing with food in this country and how does that relate to our past and how will that relate to our future?
Well, do you think that some of that has to do with, and I may be jumping ahead a little bit, but I feel that nationally in the United States that there has been a real draw towards food mm-hmm. and to food culture and to cooking, and whether you want to look at the Food Network or Top Chef, I mean, there has been a dramatic change in how the American public, and this is not elitist, as a whole, mm-hmm. looks as food. Not 100%, obviously, but I mean, for better or for worse, I look at the Food Network, mm-hmm. Top Chef, these food competition shows, and there are people, I think, who never really thought of where their lettuce came from or what kind of lettuce they were having. And, you know, I think starting in the early 90s, you saw this mm-hmm. real growth of people. There were always those who were into food, right? There was always the foodies.
Well,
you know, down through history. Yeah. You know, like there were the rich who could afford it and the poor who could not. But I think it became more available or more accessible.
Well, can I jump? Because I think, you know, if you go back to the Romans who weren't poor were into food because they could have all they wanted and throw it up and eat it again, you know. So it's more
a matter of...
Well, not eating it again, but eating more.
Okay.
So let's not be gross. But my point is it was a rich people's, you know, the interest in food then was all if you could afford it. Otherwise, you were just interested in food to stay alive.
Okay, she's a historian. Do you want to know?
Am I right, though? So that's...
Well, in terms of food history, I mean, what we're really looking at is the history of production and distribution and consumption, and that relates to all aspects of human life. I mean, producing food, we all have to eat. We all have to, you know, to feed ourselves and to do that day after day after day. And so those kinds of strands are found in any dish that you have in front of you that you're going to eat. You can unpack that and see all of the strands of people and place and in industry in producing what's on your plate. And so, you know, really looking at, well, when did foodies become, you know, important in American history? I mean, you can really look at the post-World War II period, which is a period we really deal with at the museum for food history, because that's when so many changes occurred, both in terms of technology, but also social and cultural changes in America, and people asking those questions. How are we going to feed ourselves? And how are we going to, you know, be able to keep How are we going to feed ourselves, and then how are we going to bring in all of these new technologies in a way that will be sustainable and that will also not be harmful to, you know, ourselves or the environment?
But when we go, if we look back into the 50s and we talk about sustainability, wasn't a word that was thrown around a lot as far, you know, frozen food. I mean, TV dinners, frozen foods. Mm-hmm. I think that's what lots of, you know, is about ease and.
Is there really such a thing as Salisbury steak? Because I ate a lot of it when I was little, you know, on the TV tray.
That was all about convenience. It was all about, it was all about not having to cook anymore. But then you have people like Julia Child.
Sure.
And her message was all about, you know, this is not drudgery. This is something that is important. This is something that if you care about, it can be actually pleasurable. And so, you know, Julia Child, of course, is a very important person at our museum because, you know, we have her home kitchen in
you
our
You curated
museum.
The kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
So how did that, we'll get to the other two of you, I promise, but since we're here at the
moment.
You know
what, while we're doing that, let's have a beer. That's what I say.
So how did curating the kitchen happen?
Well, we had our sort of loose food history group that was operating in the
museum.
Because
I'm trying to remember, what'd you do, her 90th birthday?
Yeah.
I was there for that.
Okay, great.
It was
2002. But, you know, we heard that she was leaving Cambridge, Massachusetts and going back to California.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we basically picked up the phone and gave her a call and asked her, well, what are your plans for your kitchen, all of the things in the kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
And that was when she said, well, you know, I have plans for some of it, but, you know, I don't know. And so we went up and talked to her about that. And within, you know, a few minutes, we sort of determined, oh, it would be great to collect this whole kitchen because it is this time capsule of the second half of the 20th century.
Right.
And it also just shows, you know, this big series of changes that occurred in that period.
Mm-hmm.
So we asked her, and she thought about it, and then she basically said, okay.
Right.
So we collected
but that was
the whole
really,
thing.
But that was your first, that was the museum's first foray into really bringing food as a part of the museum?
We had done actually a wine history project in the late 20th century. Doesn't that sound so
It sounds so
long
ago.
but we started this project with American wine history.
Mm-hmm.
And that then led into, you know, when we found out that Julia was leaving, we were set to act and make the call and then collect the kitchen.
Okay. And so let's bring it into beer. Teresa, how does beer fit into all of this, into the history, and especially at the museum?
So beer functions as this amazing complement to the work that Paula has been building for so long. And as Paula mentioned, the museum has just done a fantastic job collecting on the history of winemaking and cuisine in American culture. But the brewing collections, there's a sense that they could be expanded and really improved to kind of showcase the extent to which beer has really been part of the fabric of American life since its the start
since
of our
the
nation.
Beginning.
Right.
Right.
Right. Beer was brewed in America since before the nation's founding. It's over time, for many historical reasons, has gained this reputation as a kind of everyman's drink. And so, as I like to say, beer is truly a useful prism for me as a historian, that you can look through beer for insights into topics such as immigration or advances in transportation, technology, what what really interests me as a historian is being able to chart changes in the American palate through beer. And so my specific focus as historian of the American Brewing History Initiative has really been to look at the very recent past, which is a challenge and a privilege for me as primarily a historian of 19th and 20th century American history, but to really look from, say, the 1960s to the present at these phenomenon of home brewing and craft beer that, you know, we toss around now in conversation. You know, you go to a bar, you order a craft beer. What does that really mean? There's a historical background to how that came to be. And so to understand really the people and the places and the technologies and really the cultural forces that caused brewing to maintain this thread as really an important part of our American story.
Well, how is that showcased at the museum? Because I think people would think, well, if I'm going to learn about beer, I mean, I need to drink it, right? But there's so much more to it than that.
Yes, and an important part of all of our histories is the sensory component. It's in tasting the food, the wine, the beer that we're studying. Mm-hmm. But much of it, too, is in the material and the visual culture that really surrounds it. And that's where we come in as historians and curators at the museum. We use objects and documents to really understand this history in, you know, from all facets. And so if you come to the museum now at our archive center, which is where we hold documentary sources related to a variety of topics, you can see rich advertisements related to brewing history from the late 19th and early 20th century. You can see sheet music related to beer. There's a
songs because they love beer, or like commercial
songs
like jingles.
Songs to sing as you drink
imbibe
beer,
okay,
with your
remember
friends.
Remember when Elvis did 99 bottles of beer on the wall?
That's right.
One of my favorites.
That's right. And advertising culture too. But but I'm quite excited that part of my focus in the last almost 2 years has been to collect this more recent history of brewing and to bring in objects related to our more recent beer past.
Like what? What does that mean?
So as I began this work in early 2017, we took our initial research trip to Northern California. These mm-hmm. movements that I mentioned, craft brewing and home brewing, they really kind of got their start in the 60s and 70s, especially in the Bay Area of Northern California.
Anchor Steam.
So my very first visit actually was to Anchor Brewing Company in downtown San Francisco. It was a wonderful privilege to sit across the table from Fritz Maytag, who purchased Anchor Brewing Company in 1965. He revitalized this struggling brewery and perfected its recipe for steam beer, which is a style of beer unique to the city of San Francisco, and really and put it on the shelves to show consumers that beer could taste different.
Well, let me
different
jump in
than
the way everything tasted.
Right, I mean,
which was like, you know, the same.
Light lager styles had come to predominate in America.
I mean, after World War II, you had Budweiser, you had Schlitz, you had Miller,
Coors,
and they
wasn't there something called like Old Miss or Old Mill? Or
no, I mean there was Pabst Blue Ribbon and, you know, Baltimore and all. But the point was, I was going to ask you, like, what do you think it was that drove people to start brewing at home? Because you could go down to your corner store and get a six pack of with a different label.
Can I just back up for just
no.
a second? Didn't almost every city have a? Not every city, but most metropolitan cities have a local brewery?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. And so if you look before Prohibition, National Prohibition began in 1920, mm-hmm. you have this extremely vital history of networks of breweries that serve very local consumers. So you have, much like today, actually, you have small breweries serving consumers who lived within blocks of them. They were brewing a variety of regional ethnic styles, mostly lagers.
But if you drank PBR and you drank Budweiser, it was like drinking the same thing. It really was.
Yeah, but not in this instant. What she's saying is not dissimilar from today. There were tons of breweries in local
right.
towns before Prohibition.
This is before.
Yeah, but you're missing what I... Oh,
no, we all get what you're saying.
I wasn't
we just
here
don't agree with you.
Well, what do you know? I'm the only beer drinker here, except
right.
for... No, but that's my question. Like, what drove people to start brewing their own at home in the... Really, the 70s, late 60s, early 70s. Why?
So after the repeal of Prohibition, the breweries that were able to survive Prohibition were the ones who were brewing these light lager styles. That came to be quite boring to some Americans who, a lot of them traveled abroad.
I was going to say people started
going
traveling.
Going to Germany,
right.
Going to, right.
For educational purposes, military service in the middle of the 20th century, they went to places like Belgium and Germany and Scotland and England, and they discovered that there was this whole world of beer out there.
I hadn't thought of that. They said, oh my God, you can actually taste
it's no different
beer.
Than coffee.
Exactly. So they brought they brought brewing manuals back with them to the U.S. They brought even home brewing equipment, and they thought, you know what, the ingredients that are available here in America, I can make great beer like I could in Scotland. And so that was the story with figures like Fritz Maytag or Jack McAuliffe, who founded New Albion Brewing Company in Sonoma in 1976. And so it was really, and this is the reason why brewing fits in the history of American food at the time and American winemaking, that Americans sensed that they could take the tools and ingredients and resources available to them at the time and really build a new industry from the grassroots, from the ground up. And so it's a story of innovation, of changing tastes, but the kind of entrepreneurial spirit to make it happen.
Well, also the growth of business. I mean, D.C. is such an, I mean, for you as a historian, what a microclimate to take a look at a huge craft artisan.
Definitely.
You
sure.
Know,
yeah.
Like, and I mean, the landscape is packed.
Right. And that was part of the impetus behind, I think, founding this initiative at this time, that the brewing industry is at this enormous moment of growth, but also flux, that we now have more than 6,500 breweries in this country. Mm-hmm. There are 43,000 members of the American Homebrewers Association. It's an industry that's bigger than it's been before, but changing at the same time. And so, you know, we had this sense that now is the time to capture these stories among the first generations like Fritz Maytag, who are aging, who want to tell their stories and share their legacies. So.
Well, now I'm going to take it over to Ashley. And then after we take a break, I really want to talk about how you all work together, because you all do such interesting things. So Ashley, you came to the museum how long ago?
Just over a year ago,
actually.
That's
what I thought, a year ago, because I interviewed you a year ago.
You were my first podcast ever. It's very exciting.
Lucky you. So let's talk about what you're doing at the museum.
Yeah, so I'm the historian for the American Food History Project, so I work very closely with our food curator, Paula. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite aspects of my job is getting up on stage once a month with a guest chef for our Cooking Up History series. So I get to spend an hour on stage preparing live several dishes that speak to a theme in American history. Maybe it's migration. Sometimes we're talking about technological advances. Sometimes we're talking about the history of race relations. And we use food, this medium that everyone can relate to, to understand more complex aspects of history and talk about difficult subjects, particularly with things like discrimination. Throughout history, we can use food as a lens into why certain groups may have been marginalized in our local food economies.
Give us an example of that. That's interesting.
Sure, of course. So I can give you an example. My research actually focuses on street food vendors. So I often look at marginalized individuals historically. So think the 1800s, think New Orleans in the American South. And there were individuals there who were enslaved who actually had the ability to grow their own produce. And then they would take that produce to market and vend that food and perhaps accumulate income to eventually purchase their freedom. Mm-hmm. So they were living in a slave society, dealing with tremendous challenges, tremendous difficulties. But there were moments of agency where these individuals could actually exercise food entrepreneurship to accumulate funds to better their lives in an impossible situation. And so those are some of the stories that we try to talk about and reveal during Cooking Up History by making, for example, gumbo, which would have been sold on the streets along with pralines and other street foods that over time could have provided these individuals with sense of agency.
Was gumbo considered effectively poor people's food?
Actually, gumbo is consumed by most people living in New Orleans. It is a food that transcended a lot of race and class divisions, and something that many people living in that city, regardless of their economic status, made a claim upon, that gumbo was a part of their identity. And so gumbo is sort of an exceptional food in that way, and street foods in New Orleans at that time were available to many people, which makes it a very interesting case study.
Well, New Orleans as a whole, even though there was a very large class system, it's still kind of there today, but not when it came to food, which is kind of interesting.
I think it depends on what kind of food you're looking at. With street food in particular, you have a wider lens because the streets were where society came together, especially on Sunday, the classic market day, where you would have elites and people of working class coming together in the markets to procure food, to socialize, to kind of be present in society. And you had more kind of a fusion happening in that place than you would on a typical day. There were certainly class hierarchies in place otherwise, with certain kinds of foods that might be served at fancier dinner parties and whatnot. But certain street foods like gumbo and pralines were favorites of many individuals living in New Orleans.
So
well,
wild.
Plus you had the, I mean, there was this polyglot of voices and languages down there in the wharves. You had ships from all over the world coming in.
Yes.
So it makes sense that it would essentially, you'd have a gumbo of cultures.
Exactly. We love using that metaphor, the gumbo of cultures and the languages
I didn't
at
make
the
that
marketplace.
Up.
No,
you didn't
sorry.
Make that
you don't
up.
Get
no.
credit for it.
I want my money
all right,
back.
Well, what we're going to do now is take a quick break. So this is David and Nikki Nellis with Industry Night. We are talking with the dream team of the Smithsonian because they do fabulous food
Look
creation.
Look at them all preening.
I know, they should. It's fabulous and so exciting. And we're going to talk more about this fantastic weekend that they're putting together and things that you should absolutely do. This is David and Nikki Nellis, Industry Night. We'll be back in just a sec.
So. Up all night with the same thing in my head, just wanting you here next to me. It's been a long time, don't you agree? We can turn it all around if you say to me.
We're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David, Nikki Nellis, and we're talking about a fabulous, multifaceted food event, a celebration of food and a celebration of food in the American culture coming up at the Smithsonian from November 1st to November 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
And why don't we, you want to get into that a little?
Well, I want to talk to Paula a little bit about the event in general. You guys started it how many years ago?
This is our fourth year.
Your fourth year. Mm-hmm. Okay. I was there for the original one. And what was the impetus for it? What was the thought process behind it?
Well, we have a very strong relationship with the Julia Child Foundation for mm-hmm. Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. And they decided they wanted to award someone in the country the Julia Child Award mm-hmm. Every year. And this was started 4 years ago. And so we were talking about, well, how would that happen? And, you know, when anything is going on about Julia Child, we sort of feel like we want to be involved because we have her kitchen.
Her kitchen.
We're the home. Yeah. And so we talked about, well, maybe we should have a gala, and the award will be given to the person at the gala. Well, of course, at the Smithsonian, you know, we never do just one thing. We always try to.
You don't do things small.
No,
right.
No. And at the same time, you know, we kept thinking that we wanted to do something that would bring people together for more than an hour or two.
Mm-hmm.
We have many programs that last that amount of time, but we wanted to do something that would have some substance and continuity. And so we decided to do a festival as well as a day of roundtable discussions in conjunction with the gala.
Mm-hmm.
So we now have 3 days, Smithsonian Food History Weekend. The gala is on a Thursday night. The roundtable discussions around a certain theme are on Friday. And then Saturday is a festival with cooking demonstrations, deeper discussions, hands-on activities where we have something for everybody.
And who has won the awards all 4 years?
Well, the first year, as you know, because you were there,
right?
Jacques Pepin won the award in 2015. The next year was Rick Bayless,
right?
2016. 2017 was Danny Meyer. And this year we have two women. We have Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger, who are chefs and co-owners of Border Grill in Los Angeles.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, we're really excited.
Was there, just because of everything that's going on, was there a reason that you specifically went with women, or did you feel like it was right place, right time?
We have nothing to do with the award winner. We do not select the award.
How does it happen?
There is a committee that the Julia Child Foundation has that is specifically made up of people who look at, you know, all of the people who have been nominated, and it's very secretive. It takes place in February, March of the year, and we don't even know. We don't have a voice on the committee at all, and so we are told usually in late March or April who the award winners are, and then we go to work to create this gala that will involve speakers and elements that are very meaningful to the history of the people who are getting the award.
Right, you wanted to reflect them. Yeah. But I mean, every year you bring in a real cast of celebrities in the food world who really, I mean, so many people who cook at that level have incredible relationships and people who really want to sing their praises. So who are some of the, are we allowed to know some of the people coming to the gala?
There's great excitement about it.
Okay.
This year, the MC will be Bobby Flay, Chef Bobby Flay. And the speakers will be Barbara Fairchild, who was a,
Bon
a journalist. Bon Appetit.
You're talking about all former guests of Foodie.
Right, everybody.
Yes.
Of course, everybody has been on Foodie in the Beast. Go ahead.
And then we have Chef Tracy Desjardins from San Francisco. And finally, Kasia Alger, who is really a protege of both Mary Sue and Susan. She is going to speak from the point of view of being mentored by the duo. And she is now a business partner with Susan and also just has a very close relationship in her, with her restaurant in L.A. as well. We'll also, of course, hear from the Julia Child Foundation and, you know, as they make the award.
So who speaks for them now? Is that, was it her nephew? Was it her nephew who was doing that?
Well, no, it's Eric Spivey.
Okay.
And he is the chairman of the Julia Child Foundation.
Okay.
But you're thinking of Alex Prudhomme.
Yes, that must be who I'm thinking of.
Yes. Okay. And he will be there. He has written numerous books, as you probably know.
Of course.
And he will be there. He is on the board of the Julia Child Foundation.
Okay,
so,
terrific.
And, also, Julia's niece, Phyla, will be there. And if you ever have seen Phyla, you can see Julia because
she's
tall. 6'3", just like Julia. And it's always wonderful to have Phyla in the museum.
That's so exciting. Okay, so the gala is not open to the public.
Anybody can buy a ticket.
Okay, so you can buy a ticket. What do tickets go for?
$500.
Okay.
And this is a fundraiser. I'm hasty to note.
Of course.
That this is a fundraiser for the American Food History Project at the Smithsonian. This is how we can actually do our research, do our exhibitions, do the Cooking Up History programs and various things, is by raising money. And the gala is our major fundraiser for the year.
Excellent. Okay, so let's talk to both of you about the projects that you worked on that are going to be happening at the weekend. Who wants to start?
I'm happy to start.
Excellent.
This is Ashley. So I've been working with the team since January of this year. We've been starting to plan the roundtables. So Friday is dedicated to roundtable discussions where we bring together chefs, scholars, activists, food practitioners to talk about our annual theme, Regions Reimagined.
How does that work? There's an audience around the round table? Is that essentially how it works?
I wish we had a giant round table, but in fact, we're in our beautiful auditorium at the National Museum of American History.
No, it's a panel table.
And so we have a series of discussions that are based...
Say again, what is the theme of the weekend?
Regions Reimagined. So we're thinking about the power of place and the changing dynamics that shape our food cultures, whether you're in the Midwest or the South or the Pacific Northwest. So there are many regions in the United States. Some of them are those big kind of Midwest, Pacific Northwest, but there's even micro regions. So for example, on Saturday, we have a cooking demonstration. Now this is part of our festival with a home cook named Janice Marshall. Mm-hmm. She is from Smith Island off the Chesapeake Bay.
She's making Smith Island cake.
Well, in fact, she asked us if she could make something slightly different than Smith Island cake. She's going to be making oyster pie, but she will be showing us a fully finished Smith Island cake.
Right, because I
would
assume that takes a really long time. That's not a demo cake.
No.
Right?
And if you're not familiar with Smith Island cake, this is a multi-layer of the finest layers you can imagine of yellow cake with chocolate icing or yellow cake with vanilla icing. There's many different varieties, mm-hmm. but it involves many pans. You have to make many layers very individually, and it's an art, and it's delicious, but make sure you have your butter coffee. And I'm looking at Paula right now because she's done extensive field work with Janice Marshall and Smith Island, and so I'm really borrowing from
Paula's
knowledge.
Wait, is butter coffee from Smith Island?
Actually, it's cheese coffee, but that's...
Oh, okay. Yeah. What in God's name is cheese coffee?
Well, you have your coffee.
And then you got your cheese.
And you got your cheese.
Like what kind of cheese?
Cheddar cheese.
You put it in the coffee?
You put a little bit of cheddar cheese in your coffee, stir it up, and then you take that little glob and you put it on your toast of a morning.
I'll bet that is awesome.
It is awesome.
I'll bet that's great.
It is awesome.
Okay.
But Smith Island is full of wonderful culinary treats that like cake, coffee, and oyster pie.
Oyster pie. Okay.
So we definitely want to tell the histories of individuals like Janice, but mm-hmm. then we're also bringing in fairly well-known chefs, James Beard Award winners, like Eduardo Jordan, for mm-hmm. example, who's made a name for himself with June Baby and Solari in Seattle, Washington. He's going to come in for our roundtables on Friday, mm-hmm. as well as our cooking demonstrations on Saturday. So he's going to be preparing a Haitian Creole dish mm-hmm. and talking about African influences on American culinary culture, specifically in the American South, but then how he applies that to his restaurant in Seattle.
Seattle, right? So at these roundtables, how did you go about choosing the chefs to participate? Was it James Beard focused? Is it, you know, especially when you talk about this woman from Smith Island, like, did you look at regions and say, here's something, you know, here's a region where they make, like, we were just in Rochester, right? And so that's not, I mean, actually, the dining scene in Rochester is really thriving, but they're known for some, like, garbage plate or something, you know, like, that's,
yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, every area has something that they're known for.
Right. And that's where this idea started, because mm-hmm. one of the things that our public told us that they missed in our food exhibit was, what about American regional foods? And so this is a way for us to address that and to bring people together, not just chefs, but also scholars, but also practitioners and growers from different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of Regions Reimagined is that we all have this idea of, oh, we're in upstate New York, it must be a garbage plate or
right,
buffalo
or
wings.
Right,
or
if I'm in
like
Philly,
that.
I'm having a cheesesteak,
yeah.
right?
But we're looking at the dynamics of change in regional foodways and mm-hmm. what are the factors that influence change in how those you know traditions are expressed, adopted, used as you know to as identifiers, so used for selling a region.
Sure.
And how what matters about those changes for people today,
mm-hmm.
and so we're really looking at the change over time, and yes, of course we have two regions that we're focusing on. We're focusing on the Pacific Northwest, and also, of course, the South,
right.
and we have two Southern historians here,
right.
and so they were very key to developing, you know, how should we focus this, and what are the questions to ask when we're talking about the South.
Well, okay, so what are the questions to ask? Let's ask both of you, please.
I'll start up and then I'll pass the mic over to Teresa.
Terrific.
So one of the themes that we've been exploring throughout the year with Cooking Up History and Food History Weekend is how migration is influencing regions throughout the U.S., but particularly in the South. So we have this image that the South is all about cornbread and barbecue, and that the regional foodways haven't really changed in 100 years. But when you're in the South and you're in a city like Houston, which has a beautifully robust immigrant population, you're seeing that the foodways are constantly changing, mm-hmm. that there's influence coming from East Asia, that there's influence coming from the Middle East, and that the foodways are fusing and changing, and you're getting Cajun, you know, instead of Cajun crawfish, you're getting Viet Cajun crawfish sure. in Houston. And so that's one of the dynamics we want to look at, these kind of very present yet underrepresented foodways in the American South, and giving voice to chefs and restaurateurs who are really celebrating those food cultures.
What about...
Well, wait, let Teresa talk for just a sec.
Yeah, I just want to say that in particular, I think this roundtable is a really great example of the intersection of public conversation and historical scholarship, that in mm-hmm. historical scholarship, there's been this perennial question, you know, what is the South? Is the South exceptional? Is it different from other regions? Is it more defined compared to other regions? And so this is a great chance for us to explore that question through the lens of food.
And how
Probably
are you
depends
doing
on
that?
Where you are in
right.
the South.
Well, and how are you doing that? What are some of the roundtables that you've put together or that you're excited about?
Well, I'm quite excited about this this particular roundtable on the South. My focus for this Food History Weekend has been the conclusion, which will be last call, the Brewing History event, and we can talk about that now. Or
yeah, let's do okay. it. We're here.
Great. So Food History Weekend will conclude on the evening of November 3rd with Last Call, which is a brewing-focused evening. It's the biggest public program of the year for the American Brewing History Initiative. It's my favorite public program because we get to invite the public and brewers to our home, to the American History Museum. And so for this evening, I've planned a discussion and a kind of tasting experience related to beer, but that focuses on this question of region. And so if you want to talk about region with relation to beer, you might think first about ingredients. You know, if you're a savvy consumer of American IPAs, you might have a general sense that hops are grown in the Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. But this evening is intended to explore region on a much deeper level. And so I've invited four brewers from very different parts of the country. They're bringing amazing, unique beers. And these mm-hmm. brewers themselves have incredibly interesting stories. And can I quickly mention the four
sure.
brewers who are
Absolutely.
Coming? Absolutely. So Nuclearis Brewing Company from Nuclearis, Wisconsin, has become kind of a cult favorite brand because they've decided to distribute only within the state of Wisconsin. And so they've come to be very much associated with the state, with the experience of perhaps going to school in Wisconsin, of leisure culture in Wisconsin, but they're bringing their beer to D.C. that evening.
Well, and for the beer geeks out there, and I use that term because that's what they prefer to be called, I mean... They totally dig that stuff.
Absolutely,
I mean, they will drive
yes.
to Wisconsin to go taste that beer.
Yes, it's
a culture.
Yes. Well, if you look online, actually, you'll find people offering to drive that beer across state lines. And, you know, let's say I have a six-pack of Spotted Cow in my trunk. If you meet me in northern Illinois, I'll pass it off to you. So that's the level of dedication to this particular brewery.
Mm-hmm.
Bow and Arrow Brewing Company from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is a fantastic craft brewery in the area. It's owned by two Native American women, and mm-hmm. they'll be pouring a beer that involves... foraged Navajo tea, which is going to infuse a sour beer that evening.
That is so cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
Really, really fantastic. Scratch Brewing Company from Ava, Illinois is a great example of a farm brewery, but they're located in rural southern Illinois, and their brewers actually forage for ingredients in the area. And one of the beers they're bringing is a very special small batch beer from their SAP series. And so this beer, they replace the brewing liquor with maple. So maple syrup provides the sugars
that
create the beer. And then the fourth and final is Cajun Fire Brewing Company from New Orleans. And mm-hmm. I invited them in particular because they are, they're actually a brewery in planning. The brewer, John Renthrop, who is one of the only African-American brewmasters in the South. He also is Native American heritage. He is beginning his brewery in New Orleans East, which was previously devastated by Hurricane Katrina. And so to talk to someone who comes from multiple perspectives to the experience of building a brewery in revitalizing New Orleans, you know, I think it's a really valuable addition to the conversation.
So this whole event is really about our impact on food culturally and food's impact on us culturally. What about climate change? Because climate change is affecting food sources. And what are you seeing in terms of that impact on basically on the outcome of food as culture?
I see that very prominent in discussions amongst brewers, that they're finding that the way that hops are growing, the way that barley and other grains are being grown in this country are already being impacted by climate change. And
in
so
what way, though?
Well, reduced yields. And so especially in the Pacific Northwest, public universities are funding projects to investigate how to grow crops like hops in a changing climate.
Changing climate.
Yeah.
It's going on in the wine industry, too. Mm-hmm. Same thing. What about for both of you?
Well, if you look at a place like Smith Island, Maryland, mm-hmm. which is a very small, marshy expanse in the middle of the Chesapeake Bay, you can see that the island itself is in danger. And so...
President Trump says they're not going to let it sink.
This is not a political
That's not political.
Show.
He it's said, he came political. Out and said, we're not going to let Smith Island sink.
He didn't say that. Go ahead.
Yes, he... I beg your pardon. Does anybody else know that? He did.
Okay.
Say exactly that.
Okay.
Well, the impact that we see is that, and it's very hard to really, understand the full picture, but the weather patterns are changing, and, that, of course, has an impact on the seafood resources that are available for people in places around the bay for harvesting and for, either their own traditional food ways or the kinds of the amount of seafood that is available for selling commercially.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, something that, I've worked on the fisheries of the Chesapeake Bay for almost 35 years, and there have been huge changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question about that. And right now what we're seeing is even more dramatic changes.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. And what about you, Ashley? How does this play into your curation, or doesn't it? Or does it sort of pop up as a part of conversation?
We have different themes that we focus on when we're collecting new stories.
Mm-hmm.
Climate change certainly comes up in the conversation, but we also cover topics that go from immigration to women's entrepreneurship to gender mm-hmm. in the kitchen space. I mean, we are covering the gamut of topics through food because food is such a part of everyday life. And that's really the dynamism in our American Food History Project in the Brewing History Initiative. As Teresa said earlier, food or beer or cocktails, wine, you name it, they are the lens into everyday life for the millions of Americans and individuals living in the United States, in the industries that they're tied to, the environments that they live in. And so we really welcome really any pathway to pursue forward through the lens of food, beer, and wine. And that's what makes our job so exciting, because we can really talk to people about their passions, what's really important to their story. And sometimes it's climate change, but sometimes it's business entrepreneurship, like I mentioned.
I just have one question before because we're going to have to wrap this up soon. And we do want to talk about some of the big panels and discussions and how people can get tickets. What about appropriations? Because I feel like that has become a buzzword lately in the food world. And, I feel mixed about it. There are people who, if I love a cuisine and I cook it and I love it, aren't I showing my love of it? I'm not trying to steal it from somebody else. But then there are other people who are like, you're stealing my culture from me. It's a very tough topic.
I'll just comment on that with relation to brewing.
Mm-hmm.
The brewing industry is... in terms of producers and consumers, it has been measured as statistically largely male, largely mm-hmm. white. And it was particularly enlightening to travel to Seattle and to sit and interview Annie Johnson, who she's African-American, she's gay. She won the award from the American Homebrewers Association for Best Homebrewer of the Year in 2013. She was only the second woman of all time to win.
Huh.
And I asked her about her experiences from these various perspectives in the industry, and she said that she has encountered many barriers. One thing that she has enjoyed in particular has been the experience of becoming a beer judge and participating in brewing competitions, because she said she goes to a competition, she brews an amazing beer, and she puts it out in front of her, and it becomes totally detached from her name,
right.
and who she is, just like all the other entrants into the competition. And so at that point, it comes down to what the beer tastes like, how skillful was she in brewing this particular lager, and it turns out she was the most skillful in the room. And so, at its best, she said the industry can really can reward people who do great work, and
mm-hmm.
it has a long way to go. But the brewers I speak with are eager to make the industry more inclusive, mm-hmm. And to promote the message that that American beer is the best in the world and is intended for all.
That's a very interesting story. Ashley, Paula?
I was going to comment that in our roundtables last year, and I expect this year as well, that appropriation always comes up, even during our cooking demonstrations as well. It's a theme that various chefs or home cooks feel that they need to speak to. And what mm-hmm. I love about our museum is that we can provide individuals a platform to express their individual experiences and their particular opinions. So as a food historian, my objective is not to necessarily say this is appropriation or this is not appropriation, but rather to give a diverse array of individuals a chance to speak their piece and to share their experience as to why something might be, why food might provide conflict for them, or mm-hmm. for some others might provide a space for collaboration. And so appropriation is definitely something that is very personal, and we do try to provide a space for people to discuss and to have conversation and to represent their various opinions. But maybe Paula has something else to add.
Oh, I'll just add that, you know, many people end up saying, you know, food is dynamic. It doesn't stay in one place.
Right.
And that most people who cook, most people who eat, benefit from the What was the word you used before? The gumbo-ness mm-hmm. of food, and so if you look again historically at the many strands of place and people that come together in a dish on your plate, you know, you realize that this is a big trajectory. This is a big long story, mm-hmm. and there's no one dish that represents the personal property, and so. But at the same time, I think most people understand that if you do not credit the tradition, if you do not credit the chef or the home cook or the person in the market,
or the inspiration,
if you do not honor that, mm-hmm. then there is a problem. And so most chefs do love to talk about where this came from, the inspiration for this dish, or this inspiration for my whole menu is from, you know, this
X or
long
Y, right.
Period of inquiry, of travel, of interacting with people, and to, you know, bring
that's
it here and make
that
it around.
That goes along with the science of yeah. cooking. Yeah. But I got a question for you, because we're right. close to wrapping up.
Right.
In your first sentence, you mentioned George Washington. So we always hear about George Washington's wooden teeth. So how much of a role did crappy oral hygiene play in what we could eat and how it was prepared?
Oh, wow. You always save the best ones for me. I really appreciate that, but I cannot comment on, you know, his teeth
or his
diet.
How did he keep them in?
You know?
She just said she can't comment.
No, but think about it. How did he keep wooden teeth in?
I don't think we really want to know.
I don't want to know.
He drank a lot of beer. So
just, oh, yeah. right. It just like sucked it up, right? All right. So let's give people a rundown again of the gala weekend, because there's so many exciting things going on. And I want people to understand how they can participate. You don't just have to plunk down $500 for the gala, although we would love you to, because it is raising funds for a very good cause. Mm-hmm. But let's walk them through it.
Okay. So Thursday night, November 1st, the gala at the National Museum of American History. That mm-hmm. is a ticketed event. Please give us a call, and we'll tell you how to get a ticket. Friday is the day of roundtables, and that is all free. We would request, however, that you register online, just so we have an idea of how many people we'll have. But I'll tell you, you know, this is the fourth year, and we're really looking forward to having scholars, chefs, home cooks, practitioners, policymakers, all sorts of people, journalists, you know, on the stage talking about these issues around the power of place and identity. Mm-hmm. So that's Friday. And then if you come to the roundtables, there's also a happy hour after the roundtables. And so that's a reward.
Okay.
And then Saturday is the festival, and that's a day for everybody. We have hands-on activities. We have an activity called the Grain Elevator. Mm-hmm. And there's not enough time to tell
now,
you about it.
Is that inside or outside?
It's inside.
It's all inside.
It's in our freight elevator. So, you know, it's going to be cool. But we also have what we call deep dish dialogues. And those are conversations that go a little deeper than the roundtables. We have three of them, one featuring Aaron Sanchez, one featuring the people who wrote the book on Edna Lewis, the most recent book on Edna Lewis. And then we also have Mary Sue Milliken and Susan Feniger being interviewed by Frances Lamb on stage. And they're going to talk a little bit about, you know, their history. And then it's the cooking demos with Ashley. And there are six of them. Go
Ashley,
for it.
You're doing all six?
I wish I was doing all six. Actually, they're going to give me some little breaks in between. But we're starting off with Chef Jason Flores. We're going to be exploring Oklahoman food traditions, bringing the outdoors in. Think hunting, think game, and its importance in American cookery. Mm-hmm. We're going to be bringing Aaron Sanchez to the stage right after his deep dish dialogue, where he's going to be making his mother's mole recipe.
Fabulous.
His mother is Zarela Martinez. We had her to the museum in October. She is phenomenal, and Aaron has some fabulous stories to share with us. Then we're going to Chef Manit Chahan, who's going to be talking about Mexican Punjabi traditions, the fusion of Mexican and Punjabi food in California in the early 20th century. And then we have three more. Eduardo Jordan, who I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. is going to be coming to the stage to talk about the influence of Haiti on his cooking, as well as Janice Marshall, who I also featured earlier. And finally, Sean Sherman, who identifies as the Sioux chef. He's going to be making duck pemmican and talking about the importance of indigenous foodways in the American Midwest. And we're really looking forward to this lineup. It's going to be so fun. Each one is a
so
half an hour.
So people can just walk in and stand or take a seat.
First floor of
the demo
museum.
Stage, right. The demo stage is fabulous.
It's free.
It's like in the round.
Open to the public, and you can ask the chefs questions. We'll also have book signings for those chefs who do have cookbooks, so you can rub elbows, so to speak, with our guest chefs. It's going to be amazing.
Excellent. And then we end with?
We end with Last Call.
Last Call.
And so the four brewers I mentioned earlier, they're each pouring tastes of two beers. So you get eight beers.
And this is, you have to pay for this?
You do. You have to, you
that
do.
That would
but
seem fair. I mean, it would seem fair.
But I'm willing to share a discount code with listeners, which is brewing. So if you go to the website s.si.edu /last call, you can buy your tickets, get $5
off. If you're sober and you can remember that, then you just
brewing.
Brewing, yes. And we'll have archival objects out of storage, panel conversation, beer to taste, and heavy appetizers.
How much fun. All right, let's give the website, please, to everybody. Come on, somebody's got to know the website.
I'm sure we've got it here.
We know we have three historians here, but nobody knows their website.
Okay, it's s.si.edu/Smithsonian Food, one word.
Or you can just Google Smithsonian Food History Weekend.
Exactly,
and you'll 2018.
And I do want to say, not to self-promote, but the list areyouonit.com does have every event happening at the Smithsonian for this festival.
A shameless
and it's
plug.
Not a shameless plug. It's a fact. If you want to find out about it, it's all there, so you can find out about all of it. So we want to thank our guests for joining us today. This was a really fabulous and interesting conversation. And we want to thank you. It looks like a lot of YouTubers are here for tuning in and listening to us. This is David and Nikki Nellis. We are Industry Night in the Gorgeous Line Hotel. We also do Foodie and the Beast, which is a show that airs every Sunday live. What do you want to
mention? The 11th.
That's what I was going to do. We are celebrating our 10-year anniversary of the show, and on November 11th, we're doing a huge 2-hour party at Blue Jacket, which is celebrating their 5-year anniversary. So a little bit of brewery news.
A brewery.
There. Yes, exactly. But we're going to have some of the best and brightest from the D.C. metro area joining us. There'll be some champagne. There'll be some beer. There'll definitely be lots of food. So we do hope you will join us. Once again, thank you to our guests for joining us today. And everybody, please have a delicious week.
Thank you, Nikki.
So
thank you, David.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening. Wow.